The Bob Murphy Show, Episode 28.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. In this particular episode, we are resuming with our fascinating, exhilarating, indeed enlightening and life-transforming series on capital and interest theory in the Austrian tradition. So right now, this is the second of the three-part series. You'll recall back in episode 26 of The Bob Murphy Show, we started this series, and there what we covered was Bombavrick's critique of the naive productivity theory, and then at the tail end, I reconciled his critique with the modern mathematical economist's approach to this stuff, where it seems to be the case that in equilibrium, the real rate of interest equals the marginal product of capital. So it seems like the modern mainstream economists are codifying what Bombavrick blew up as a naive productivity theory. What gives? Well, don't worry. I'm not going to recapitulate it here. If you missed it or if you want to hear it again, go back to bobmurphyshow.com/26. So today, for this part two of our series on capital and interest in the Austrian tradition, we are going to be covering Bombavrick's own positive theory of capital. And in particular, Bombavrick's agio theory or agio theory. I'm not sure the best way to say it in English. It's spelled A-G-I-O, theory of interest. Okay, so again, Bombavrick in volume one of his magisterial three-volume compilation had his history and critique of interest theories, and he has this taxonomy and just classifies and in his mind refutes every other type of explanation: the exploitation theory, the abstinence theory, the naive productivity theory, all these different types of theories of interest where other economists have tried to explain why is it that capitalists seem to earn this effortless flow of, I think he called it flow of wealth. I think, you know, more modern terminology, we would just call it net income or a flow of consumption without impairing your capital stock. Okay, so that's what he's trying to explain. And so he goes through it, in my opinion, masterfully blows up everybody else's attempt. But after a while, you're like, all right, Eugen, if at this point you're on a first name basis with him, you're pretty good at criticizing everybody else. Well, why don't you tell us what the right theory is? And so that's what he tries to do. So that's what I'm going to focus on in this episode, to explain what Bombavrick's own approach was. And then at the tail end of this episode, I am going to mention some of the critics of his approach, and I'm going to focus on the criticism of Frank Fetter and Ludwig von Mises, because obviously that's pretty important for Austrian listeners. And by the way, just to give you the big, big, big picture of this, the reason I'm going through all this, well, there's two things. Number one, this is kind of my area, and so I want to just get this down for posterity's sake, again, in case I get hit by a bus. I say that a lot, and I don't, it's not that like I'm thinking, I don't have a premonition. I don't think that I'm going to get hit by a bus, but I could be. And I feel like as I'm lying in the gutter after being hit by a bus, I'll be glad that I have gotten this stuff down. That's all I'm saying. And then the other reason is people have asked me if I can explain what my problem is with the pure time preference theory of interest. That's what we're going to do in the third part of this series. Okay, so that the pure time preference theory of interest is the standard canonical Austrian explanation of interest, which is different from the mainstream. So when you say, hey, what's the big deal with Austrian economists? And, you know, they go through and they list all the reasons that they're different from and better than the standard mainstream neoclassical economist. One of the big dividing issues is the explanation of interest. And the mainstream economist does say, oh, interest is due to the marginal product of capital. And we've already seen why that's wrong. But I also have problems with the standard Austrian alternative, namely what's called the pure time preference theory of interest. And so I've had people asking me to explain what my problem is. And they've also said, I think Tom asked me on the air, so I don't think I'm revealing anything, but I think some point down the road, if Jeff Herbner's willing, people were saying, oh, Tom, why don't you have Jeff Herbner and Bob Murphy on to, you know, hash out their differences when it comes to pure time preference theory? Because Jeff has defended the pure time preference theory's honor from punks like me, right? So anyway, I couldn't just do that, given that I was going to try to do what some of you are asking and explain my problem with the pure time preference theory. It would have been crazy to just jump right into that, because you need to know the whole backstory of Bombavich's critique of the naive productivity theory, because you got to understand what's the word pure doing in pure time preference theory. And you can't know that unless you know what do mainstream economists think in terms of time preference, and what role does that play in the determination of equilibrium interest rates, right? So you kind of need to know all that stuff. You can't just jump right in and start with Mises. So that's why I'm doing this three-part series. Okay. Well, that was a pretty long preamble, wasn't it? So here we go. Now we're jumping in. So Bombavich says, when he's warming up, getting ready to explain his own theory, he says, the nub in kernel, that's his phrase, of course, translated into English, the nub in kernel of his own theory is the insight that, and here's a quote, present goods are, as a rule, worth more than future goods of equal quality and quantity. So I'll say that one more time. Bombavich is saying the following claim is the nub and kernel of his own explanation of interest. And the observation is this: present goods are, as a rule, worth more than future goods of equal quality and quantity. All right, so let's just stipulate that that's true. Okay, so just bear with me for a moment. Assume that that's correct. Assume that it is true that, generally speaking, present goods are worth more than future goods. And again, when we say that, I mean, I'm not going to keep saying all the conditions, because he says of equal quality and quantity. So let's just deal with, let's just clarify, what does he mean by that phrase or that statement? So it wouldn't be a contradiction of that to say, hey, you know what? I would prefer to have a diamond delivered next week rather than having an orange delivered today. And then, isn't that showing a case where a future good is worth more than a present good? Because I want the future diamond more than the present orange? Well, no, because those are not of equal quality. Well, they're of equal quantity, it's one and one, but they're different types of goods, and they're certainly not the same quality. Okay, even if you got fairer with it and said, oh, let's just confine ourselves to pizza. And you say, oh, is it always the case that present pizza is preferable to future pizza? And what if the actual choice you presented to me was a really thin crust pizza with just a tiny little smattering of sauce on it and just a little bit of, you know, patches of cheese here and there, but mostly like the cheese didn't even cover it. And that's what I could have right now, or next week I could have this real gourmet pizza that's just smothered in cheese and, you know, has the right amount of sauce on it and lots of pepperonis and da da da. And it's, you know, there, if I said, oh, I'd rather have the future pizza than the present pizza, that wouldn't be a violation of Bombavich's rule either, because they would be different qualities, right? That, as I described it there, that future pizza sounds much more appetizing. All right. It also, of course, wouldn't be a refutation of this rule to say, even if we held the quality fixed, that, okay, it's the same quality pizza in both periods, and said, oh, would you rather have two pizzas delivered next week or one pizza right now? And if I happened to say I'd rather have two next week, that clearly wouldn't be an example of me preferring future goods to present goods, because there the quantity is different. Okay, so I'm walking through this, but I just want to make sure you understand why he's putting these qualifiers in his statement. Okay, so he's saying, if you're holding quality and quantity fixed, then as a general rule, present goods are worth more than future goods. And that worth more, you could say, well, what does he mean by that? And he means in the first place in terms of subjective valuation. But then in line with the new subjective marginal utility approach to market value, that also implies that the market valuation is also reflecting that preference. All right, and if you remember back in episode 26, I said one way that I like to interpret or explain what Bombauer did is he took the insights of Menger, who had basically from scratch developed subjective marginal utility theory and used it to displace the old objective classical approach to value theory, and Bombauer systematically applied it in an intertemporal context. All right, so ultimately, if Menger wants to explain why is it in the marketplace that one orange has a higher price than one apple, ultimately it's going to be because, oh, the marginal utility of one orange is higher than the marginal utility of one apple. So you could say people subjectively prefer one orange to one apple. Again, on the margin, you're not looking at classes of objects. And so that, you know, that's how the stuff lines up. So it's, when you say worth more, it's both in subjective value and in terms of market value. All right. I'm being loose here because it gets tricky how things get equilibrated in terms of equilibrium. And we're talking about things being true on the margin. All right. So very quickly, in case you're worried, I mean, it's somebody who like really likes oranges is going to buy a lot of oranges, and he's going to keep buying them until the point at which, oh, if I bought one more orange, then, you know, it wouldn't be worth the last unit of money that I would have to spend. And you're doing the same thing with apples. Okay. So in case you're wondering, like, how am I going to reconcile all that? Am I saying everybody has the same preferences? No, I'm not saying everybody in general has the same preferences. Just saying once you go out and optimize and buy your optimal quantities of oranges and apples, it ends up being true on the margin that those relationships hold up. All right. I'm not going to pursue that any further, because if you don't know what I'm talking about already, it would take too long for me to explain it. So, but I'm just mentioning that in case you were concerned. All right. So likewise, if a present good is more valuable than a future good, well, what does that mean? Well, you can think of it in terms of market value. So that means it has a higher market value. So what does that mean? Well, it means, for example, if you sold the present good for money, you'd get more dollars, and then you could use those dollars to buy more units of the future good, right? Because the present good's more valuable. So that's one way of thinking about it. Or you could just think of it directly in terms of utility and say, oh, what we mean when we say it's more valuable or it's worth more is that subjectively it's higher on our preference scales, the particular marginal units. All right, so for example, if you were given a choice and saying, do you want one more unit of this present good, or do you want one more unit of this good not to be delivered until the future, which do you choose? Well, if the present good is worth more than the future good, you'd pick the present good. Okay, so assume for the moment that that's true. Would that explain the interest problem as Bombauer defined it? And I want to say, yes, it does. So remember the kind of thing we were worried about back in episode 26. Bombauer wanted to know, let's say there's a tractor that every year yields you a net income of $10,000. And let's say the tractor has a working life of 10 years. And then after that 10th year, the tractor just collapses all of a sudden. It's completely useless. You can't even sell it for scrap. And so then the question is, why is it that a capitalist, somebody who has money up front, who invests financially in this tractor and then uses it, incorporates it into the farmer's operation, why is it that the capitalist over time typically will be able to not only get his original financial investment back, but will earn a return above and beyond that he can then go consume if he wants to and still leave that original capital value intact? Why is that the case? And remember, we said the naive productivity theory said, oh, it's because the tractor is productive. And if you pushed the naive productivity theorist, they would say, yeah, I mean, the farmer can harvest more crops with the tractor than without. And in fact, bring more crops to market means he gets more revenue. So, you know, what's the mystery here? Of course, investing in the tractor reaps the capitalist a return. And Bombauer showed in his critique of the naive productivity theory that is a bad explanation. That doesn't solve the problem at all. All that explains is why the tractor has a positive rental price, or why it has a price at all, whether you're thinking of buying it or renting it. it doesn't explain why the original purchase price is less than what you're expecting the total lifetime yield to be accruing to the tractor. That's the thing to be explained. It's the apparent undervaluation of that tractor when you first buy it. It seems like you have to pay less for it than you expect it's going to actually contribute over its lifetime. And it's only that mismatch that explains why is it over time the capitalist, in a sense, gets out more dollars than he originally put in. Again, I'm speaking colloquially here just to try to move this along and not get too bogged down in technicalities. Okay, so again, we saw the naive productivity theory explanation by itself doesn't work. It doesn't solve the problem merely to tell me the tractor is physically productive or even to say it's physically productive and the excess physical output that the tractor produces translates into a higher market value of the enterprise. Those statements, though true, don't explain why investment in the tractor yields a positive rate of return. So what about Bombavrick's approach? What if we just stipulate for the sake of argument that generally speaking, present goods are more valuable than future goods, or they're worth more than future goods? Would that explain it? And yes, it would. Because when you buy the tractor at time zero, you're using, at that moment, present dollars. And yet, from that vantage point, when you're looking out over the 10-year horizon and you're saying, oh, at the end of year one, I'll have $10,000 to my name because of the tractor. At the end of year two, I'll have another $10,000 and so forth. Those future expected cash flows are not present dollars, they're future dollars. And so if it's true that as a general rule, present goods are worth more than future goods, well, that's also true for dollars. And so you can see why you wouldn't pay the same number of dollars right now in the present for dollars that won't be accruing to you until the future, because a present dollar carries a premium. Now, incidentally, if you're worried that I'm sort of begging the question or assuming the conclusion because you're saying, well, interest really is just the fact that present dollars exchange at a premium for future dollars, I kind of agree with you. So you're sort of anticipating what my own approach to interest is. But we can allay those fears if we get rid of money. And we can just think of it in terms of a real theory of interest. And when I say real here, I use it in the sense where people mean inflation adjusted. So economists might talk about, you know, oh, what's the real wage that the worker earns? And so he means it's not just the nominal money wage rate, but in terms of the purchasing power. So like if prices in general double and your nominal wage rate doubles also, you'd say the real wage was unaffected. Okay, so that's the sense of when I talk about real in the rest of this series, that's what I mean. So real, what you could also do is just think of it in terms of physical goods. So you're not worried about money, you're worried about the actual commodities changing hands and like physical output. Okay, so you could think of it in terms of that. And so imagine another example that I used last time where I said, oh, you got an apple tree. And the apple tree each year shoots out, 10 apples. And then after the 10th year, the world ends. Okay. And so then the question is, if you invested in the apple tree, would you earn a rate of return over time as a capitalist? And so it depends on what's the market price of that tree up front quoted in apples, right? So we're not using money. We're doing it in barter terms. So I'm a capitalist in the beginning, and I imagine apples are like the basket of consumption goods in this economy, right? That's the only consumption good there is apples. All right, so if you had wealth stored up, it would be in the form of apples. Or it could be claims on apples, by the way. It doesn't have to be physical apples, but people are expressing their wealth in terms of apples, if you want. That's the numeraire, okay? So if the apple tree originally had a market price of 100 apples, remember we walked through and showed, even though the tree is physically productive and even though it gets paid its marginal product, nonetheless, the capitalist in that setting would earn a 0% rate of return, right? He'd pay 100 apples up front for the tree. At the end of the first year, the tree would have produced 10 apples, but then the market value of the tree would have dropped to 90. And so the capitalist now, in terms of his property, would have a tree that has a market value of 90 and 10 apples. And so the total wealth of that combination of things would still be 100 apples. So it's what he started out with. And then by the end of the second period, the tree would have a market value of 80 apples. And now he would have 20 apples to his name that the tree physically produced, or that he, if he rented it out to somebody, he could, they would have had to pay him in equilibrium 10 apples per period. Okay. So that just shows it, the capital loss of the tree, right? It's not that the tree's physically deteriorating. It's just the world's going to end after 10 periods. And so the remaining output of the tree that you're including when you go to price it keeps shrinking by 10 every period. Okay, so that you, it would be a capital loss. Like I said, it's not physical depreciation. It's just a capital loss. But still, the point being, when you calculate correctly as an accountant, the total rate of return on that investment, every year it would be 0%. Your wealth would just be 100 apples. The form of the wealth would change over time. You know, initially it'd be 100 apples. Then for a split second, it would be just one tree that was worth 100 apples. Then at the end of period one, you'd have a tree worth 90 apples and 10 more apples. Just adding up to 100 at the end of period two, you'd have a tree worth 80 and now you'd have 20 apples. Okay, that's the way it would work. But at any given time, your wealth would still be 100 apples. So the rate of return over time would be 0%. Okay, but in that world, notice, it would have to be the case for that to make sense that a present apple traded on the market at par with a future apple. That's the only way that that tree at the beginning of period zero would have a market price of 100 apples. If instead present apples traded at a premium to future apples, then that wouldn't be the case. Okay, so I'm trying to see if it'll help or hurt if I try to do it numerically. If you go to the second last period and the tree, you know, right at the end of that, and so the tree in one period in the future is going to yield that last burst of 10 apples, and let's say the rate of interest is 100%, then what ends up happening is that tree that next period you think is going to yield one last burst of 10 apples, right now, the period before, it's only going to have a value of 5 present apples. So again, we're right now considering things from the vantage point of the second last time period, just to keep the math simple. I just want to do it for one period instead of doing it for 10, because it's going to be too hard for you to follow me if we're doing it, if you're driving or something. I don't want you to get in an accident. Okay, so you're in the second last period and you're trying to value this tree that, from your perspective, one period from now is going to shoot out a burst of 10 apples. So from your perspective, the tree is like a technological claim ticket on apples to be delivered in one period. And so if we're saying in this world now, present apples are much more valuable than future apples, then what ends up happening, suppose it's such that when you're right now considering, how many apples would I give up right now in order to get 10 apples delivered to me one period from now? Suppose the market rate of that is 5 apples, right? So if they were equally valuable, you would give up 10 apples now in order to get 10 apples next period. Because to you, present apples and future apples would be the same thing. They'd exchange at par. But we're saying that's not the case. We're saying suppose present apples are more valuable to you than future apples are. So that means if you give up one apple right now, you're going to have to be promised more than one apple in the future. And now I'm just being more specific just to give a nice round number. And I'm saying, suppose it's the case, to keep the math easy, that for you to give up 5 apples right now, you're going to have to be promised 10 apples one period from now. So that's an example of present apples being more valuable than future apples, in fact, being twice as valuable. Okay, so if that happens, that means the tree right now, going into that last period has a market value of only 5 apples, even though one period from now it's going to shoot out 10 apples. Because right now you're valuing it with present apples, and what the tree is going to deliver to you is only future apples. So if that's the case, if you have 5 apples right now, you could use them to buy the tree. You wait one period, the tree then shoots out 10 apples. And so your wealth measured in apples each period went from 5 apples to 10 apples for 100% rate of return. All right. More generally, if you're buying factors of production, like let's say you're going to build a house. And so you're buying the lumber and the bricks and the glass and hiring workers, and they're all mixing their stuff together. And then a year later, you sell the house for $100,000. That is going to be more, typically, than the total dollar amount you had to spend on all the materials and hiring the labor. Because when you spent the money on those materials and the labor, the house at that point, the revenue from it was just a distant future good. And so you would not pay the full $100,000 back when you bought all that stuff, because at that point, the $100,000 was a future revenue. All right. So again, I'm just trying to get you to see whether you think of it in terms of barter terms or money terms. If, generally speaking, present goods are more valuable than future goods, then that explains why it is, if you have present goods at your disposal, at your command in the present, and you're willing to exchange them away for things that will only give you command of goods down the road in the future, you're going to be able to trade your certain number of claims on present goods right now for a greater number of claims on future goods. All right. And so this is really this is the easiest way to think about it. Forget about physical transformation and physical production process. Just think of it in terms of claim tickets, right? So forget where apples come from. Suppose you don't even know. You don't know how apple trees work. All you know is you go into the marketplace and you've got 5 apples. And you're saying, you know what? I'm considering selling my 5 apples that I have right now in my possession in order to get apples delivered to me 1 year from now. What can I get for them? And you look around and there's, you know, futures markets and commodities markets. And some guy says, hey, if you give me those 5 apples right now, I will give you these tickets. And each ticket says the owner of this ticket is entitled to 1 apple to be delivered 1 year from now. You know, it's got the date stamped on it. It happens to be 1 year from today's date. And he says, I will give you 10 of these tickets if you give me those 5 apples right now. And suppose, you know, you trust this guy. He's extremely reputable. There's no doubt in your mind he's going to follow through on it, right? So we're abstracting away from the risk of default. Airtight claims to future delivery of apples. And so if it turns out that the market price there, the exchange rate, the going rate of future apples to present apples is 2-1, there's nothing mysterious about that, right? We're just using an intertemporal market. Just like if I said, well, gee, what if 1 apple trades for 2 oranges? All right, I go on the marketplace and I have 5 apples and I say, I'd like to exchange my apples, my present apples for present oranges. And I sell my 5 apples and someone gives me 10 oranges. Right? There's nothing mysterious about that. We would just say, ah, okay. Well, an apple has twice the market value of an orange. And that's why if you sold 5 apples right now, you'd get 10 oranges right now. Okay, so now I'm saying the same thing, except I'm selling my 5 apples right now and what I'm getting in exchange is not present oranges. What I'm getting are claims to future apples. And suppose it happens to be the case that 5 present apples right now fetches me in the market 10 claims on future apples, right? There's no reason that that couldn't happen. That would be consistent with present goods being more valuable than future goods. Just like if 5 present apples traded for 10 present oranges, I would say apples are more valuable than oranges. That's what that would mean, okay? So, but what I want you to see is think about the implications of that. If it were the case, period after period, that you could always sell a given number of present apples for twice as many future apples, Well, then look what would happen. You start out with 5 present apples. You sell them for claim tickets of 10 future apples. 1 year passes. You turn over your 10 claim tickets and the guy says, yep, there you go. I remember issuing you those things. Here you go. I'm a man of my word. Here's 10 present apples. Now I got 10 present apples. If you want, you can eat 5 of them. And then you're back to where you started. You have your 5 present apples again. And then you do the same thing. You sell those 5 present apples. You get 10 claim tickets saying 1 year from now on that date, the bearer of this ticket gets a present apple and you got 10 such tickets. So you wait a year, you get 10 apples, you eat 5 of them, and you just keep doing that. So I've just shown you how, if it were the case that a present apple exchanged in terms of claims on future apples at a premium, you could period after period enjoy a perpetual flow of consumption where you're just eating apples period after period, even though you're not producing anything, right? It doesn't look like you're doing anything productive, does it? All you're doing is you keep selling off apples and then getting a greater number a year later, and you're eating what we would call as your interest return. And you're just making sure you're not consuming, you're not eating into the capital base, right? So make sure you see how that works and how that would explain Bombavrick's mystery or his interest problem. If you're just thinking of it in terms of the physical commodities and you're selling them for claims, like in forward markets, if you know how forward contracts work, or you can think of it as futures contracts, but actually it's more straightforward if you know what a forward contract is, think of it that way. All right, so I hope that's real straightforward. The problem with this stuff is it can get really complicated, but each little part is actually simple. All right, so I'm just trying to get you to see that there's nothing really mysterious here. If it were the case that you could always sell present apples for a greater number of claims on future apples, then if you were willing to defer your consumption, you would be able to enjoy a perpetual flow of net income, of net consumption over time, so long as you always just consumed what your net income amount was. You didn't eat into that capital base, literally. Okay? So if that makes sense to you, now let's get a little fancier and realize that there are other ways to transform present goods into future goods. So one way, like we just talked about, is if you actually go into a market where you sell them against claims on future goods to be delivered, like commodities markets or with, forward and futures contracts. But you could also just go directly into production. If you had labor, hours of labor and lumber and glass and so forth, and you knew the technological recipe for making a house, but it takes time to do it. Let's say it takes a year to get all the stuff to come together and bring it to market and so forth. Well, then in a sense, if you have all the right materials and you have the technological know-how, your command of those present factors of production is like a technological claim ticket on a future house. And so if you understood how the discounting works with the apples, it's a similar thing here, where if you're willing to give up your command of present goods, they transform into something that down the road at that moment has a higher market value than what the market value was at the time you devoted the factors to building the thing. Just like there's a sense in which you transformed 5 apples today into 10 apples 1 year from now. By the same token, in that world, if you had 10,000 apples worth of raw materials, right? Like if the apple is sort of like the numeraire that we're using, and you could think, if you want to hire some workers, you got to pay them this many apples per hour, and you want to buy a bunch of lumber, well, that's going to cost you, 6,000 apples, right? So if everything's quoted in apple prices and you had 10,000 apples and you hired a bunch of people, you bought a bunch of lumber and glass and blah, 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 and then you made a house that would, when I say 10,000, then the house would sell for 20,000 apples. I'm forgetting what numbers I said, but it would still be double in equilibrium, right? It would have to be. In fact, if you took into account the fact that it's riskier to build a house and try to sell it, there would actually be a greater premium, but let's not worry about risk right now. Let's just assume for sure And the way it would work, it's the other way around. You looking forward, knowing, oh, this house that I could build, I think 1 year from now, that kind of a house of the dimensions I have in mind, blah, 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 the neighborhood and so forth, I could sell that for 20,000 apples. That means right now the most you would spend on the factors to build it is 10,000, because you would be stupid to spend more than that, because you could just go into the commodities markets, right? We've already said you could, if you had 10,000 apples right now, you could just go buy 20,000 claim tickets on future apples to be delivered in a year. So it'd be stupid for you to spend more than a total of 10,000 apples worth on factors of production that are going to build a house that you expect to be able to sell a year from now for 20,000 apples. So that's the way the discounting process would work. Okay, so the thing driving all of it, these little examples, is the underlying assumption that present apples are more valuable, they're worth more, both subjectively and in market value terms, than future apples. If we just grant that for the sake of argument, everything else follows naturally. Okay, so I hope I've hammered that point home so you see it, but I didn't belabor it too much. So now let's continue. Bombauer didn't stop there. You know, he establishes that, look at, if we assume for the sake of argument that present goods are worth more than future goods of like kind and quantity, then that solves the interest problem. But he didn't stop there. He said, okay, so why should it be the case that present goods as a general rule are more valuable than future goods? Hey, everybody, let's take a break from my discussion of Bombauer to talk about Liberty Classroom again. If you're the kind of person that's still awake after hearing me talk about Bombauer, I think you should really check out Liberty Classroom, and in particular, my two courses on the history of economic thought. I cover things in the second course that are more modern, the 20th century, stuff like public choice, Arrows and Possibility Theorem, the Lucas critique of Keynesian models, stuff like that. In the first course, we do the classical economists, we do the marginal revolution. I do a lot on Bombauer, which is a longer elaboration than the stuff that we do here on the Bob Murphy Show. So if you like what you're hearing here, you would get more of it there. And I think it's good stuff. So, and you know what? It's not just all about me. There's other things. Tom's in there, Brad Berzer, Jeff Herbner, Kevin Gutzman, lots of people. It's good stuff. So all I ask, though, don't go to the URL that you might think you should go to. Instead, go to bobmurphyshow.com/28. That's what you're listening to right now. And click on the Liberty Classroom link in the show notes page, because it's special and it will remember that it came from me, so that Tom has to redistribute income from the haves to the have-nots. So here's now where stuff gets controversial. So he has three main causes to try to explain this general phenomenon by which present goods are more valuable than future goods. Because again, that's what explains interest. Okay, so here's, I'm going to say this several times probably, but it's critical. And just so you understand why I'm stressing this, this is why I think Fetter and Mises misunderstood what Bombauer was doing. Okay, so Bombauer's explanation for interest was present goods are more valuable than future goods, full stop. That's the explanation. One way of putting it is present goods being more valuable than future goods is necessary and sufficient for a positive real rate of interest. Okay? And so that's his theory. But now he wants to explain it more. He doesn't just want to say, oh, because they are. He wants to say, why are they? Why are present goods more valuable than future goods? And for that, he gives three separate causes. The first cause is that, generally speaking, in market economies, we expect to be wealthier in the future. And so because of that, we would tend to value, if we have to choose between getting one more unit of a present good or one more unit of a good not to be delivered until the future, you would take it now. Just because, you know, there's various terms. You could use the term consumption smoothing. It has to do with diminishing marginal utility, if you're familiar with that concept, right? So go back to apples. If you think over time the amount of apples at your command is just typically going to get bigger and bigger, right? Because they got improved agricultural techniques or, you know, whatever the reason. But just over time, if you expect your ability to get your hands on apples is going to get easier and easier or better and better. So it's easier and easier for you to get more apples over time. And then I say to you right now, hey, I can give you an apple right now, or I'll give you this airtight ticket that's a claim or airtight claim, which is a ticket on an apple to be delivered 12 months from now or 24 months from now or 36 months from now. Which do you want? Which do you prefer? Well, you're going to say, give me the apple right now, because right now you're relatively poor in apples. Whereas you're looking down 5-6 years in the future, your future self is going to be awash in apples. So you would rather get one on the margin right now. Okay, so that's the first cause. That's a reason, to the extent that that's true, totally makes sense that, yep, that's one reason that people tend to prefer present goods to future goods, is because people are going to tend to grow wealthier over time. Okay. A second cause Bumbavert discusses is that people systematically tend to discount future satisfactions. So this is more of like a psychological phenomenon. This also has to do with what Bumbavert refers to as a weakness of willpower. Okay, so here, so notice that this is different from the first cause. So with the first cause, there was nothing, quote, irrational going on. There wasn't a kind of misperception. It really was the case that, you know, right now when you've only got a few apples, one more apple is going to make a huge difference to you. You're really going to appreciate getting, like, let's say you've only got 10 apples right now. That 11th apple is going to be pretty good. Whereas a decade from now, maybe you're going to have 100 apples that year. So if you got one more apple, that would just be your 101st apple to your future self. So to your future self, that's not really, you know, 101st apple. That's not nearly as important to you as the 10th or the 11th apple is. Okay. So that there's nothing, you know, there's no myopia. There's no psychological impatience going on there. There's no systematic undervaluation of future satisfactions. It's just, no, even if you were perfectly aware of exactly how you'd feel 10 years from now, the fact that at that moment, one more apple would only be would actually be the 101st apple, you're correctly saying, nah, that's not very important to me. And if I have a choice, I'd rather get one more apple delivered right now when I would really benefit more from it. Okay, in contrast, Bumbavert is saying there's a separate thing going on. Even if you did have the same amount of wealth period after period, people just tend to discount future satisfactions just because they are in the future. Okay, so suppose every year you are just going to have 10 apples at your disposal, and now someone's saying, you know what, I'm going to give you an apple as a gift. When do you want to get it? I can give it to you right now, or I'll give it to you 10 years from now. When do you want it? And so suppose, you know, yourself 10 years from now, that 11th apple is going to be just as enjoyable to you at that moment as you right now getting that apple would enjoy it too. Nonetheless, you're going to say, give it to me right now, because that future self, it's hard for you even to imagine that person, right? That the needs you're going to have, or the desires or satisfactions you're going to enjoy 10 years from now, to you right now making the decision, that doesn't weigh as heavily in your mind as your current desires do. Okay, so Bumbavert's saying, you can say that that's a weakness of the will, you can call it myopia, you can criticize it, but it's a real thing. Right? That really is how people behave. And that's how they value things that, you know, that unfold over time. And so that's a second reason. Okay, so again, notice that's independent from the first reason. Those are not saying the same thing. Those are different things, but both of them, each independently, would cause you to prefer getting a present unit of a good rather than an airtight claim on that same unit of a good not to be delivered until the future. Okay, now we come to the most controversial one, the third cause that Bumbavert offered for why present goods tend to be more valuable than future goods. And here he said another independent reason is that what he referred to as the technical superiority of present goods compared to future goods. And more specifically, Bombavrik was saying roundabout production processes are more physically productive. And so that's why, other things equal, you would prefer to have a present good versus a future good. So here, I don't want to get bogged down too much in this, but let me just quickly explain what he meant. So a roundabout process, a lot of people think that all Bombavrik was saying is a longer process, but technically, no, that's not what he was saying. I mean, there's a reason they translated his term as roundabout. Bombavrik could have said longer. He didn't. He said roundabout. So what roundabout means is that you're not directly attacking the goal. You're using a more circuitous approach. So for example, let's say somebody's out in the woods and he's got a cabin and there's a stream that's 100 yards from the cabin and he wants to get water into the cabin. So one approach is the person just goes and gets down on his hands and knees and, you know, cups his hands and fills his hands with water and then walks that back to the cabin. And, you know, like if he's trying to fill a bathtub or something. All right. He could just keep making trips that way, just cupping his hands, maybe putting his face in the water and filling his mouth up too and spitting that in the tub. All right. So that would be a very direct approach. That's not roundabout. That's using his labor to directly go and start doing the thing that it is he's trying to achieve. And somebody watching that would know exactly what he was doing. Like, oh yeah, his goal is to move water from the stream into his bathtub and he's doing it all right. It's taking him a long time, but he's doing it. Okay. What if instead though, the guy's sitting there, scratches his head, and he's looking around and then he goes and gets a coconut and he cracks it open and he hollows it out. And then he goes now with the two coconut halves and he uses those as like little bowls and he starts filling those up and making trips back and forth with these little bowls that he just made. So at first, if you saw him cracking open the coconut, you might not know what he was doing. You might not think, oh, well, yeah, what he's doing is because he wants to put water in the bathtub. You might think he's hungry. It would only be later when you saw what he was doing. Oh, he was making the tools. Okay. All right. So that would be a more roundabout approach. And then, you know, in the extreme, suppose he cuts down trees and he builds himself a shovel and he digs a big trench and he, you know, he makes like a lock system and whatnot. So eventually he just redirects and has the stream going right into his cabin somehow. And he, you know, depending on how much ingenuity he has and so forth and his skills of engineering and carpentry, you know, you can imagine all sorts of crazy, cool stuff that he builds. And you'd come back 10 years later and see what he did. And, oh, wow, okay, he's got like basically running water going into his house. Wow, bravo. Okay, but imagine all the detours he would have to take. He would have to first build tools that would help him build tools that would help him build tools to eventually, you know, dig out that channel and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so that would be a far more roundabout way of getting the water from the stream into his bathtub. So notice in practice, roundabout and longer can go hand in hand, but they're conceptually distinct. And I won't mention it now, but Bombavrik even gives an example of a production technique that's more roundabout but shorter, right? Yeah, I think so. All right, so those are not synonymous. They're conceptually distinct, and you can come up with contrived examples where they are different. They refer to different processes, okay? So Bombavrik's claim is that that empirically speaking, a suitably chosen more roundabout process will be more physically productive. So he's saying at any given time, no matter what we're using for our production technique, if we could imagine or there exists a more roundabout technique that would be more physically productive, and physically productive meaning if you looked at the measurement of the output of what you're trying to achieve, physically speaking, compared to the physical amount of inputs that you had to use. And you're not worried about the time element. Okay, so with the example I just made up for you guys, if we were looking at labor time compared to gallons of water put in the bathtub, so that first very direct non-roundabout method of just using your hands and possibly your mouth to move the water from the stream into the bathtub, if you calculated and said how many hours of your labor would you have to spend in order to get 1 gallon of water in there, it would be a big number. If instead you first went and got the coconut and cracked it open and hollowed it out and did that way, over time, it would be lower, right? That, you know, in order for you to get 100 gallons that way, it would take you fewer labor hours than 100 gallons the other way. To get the first gallon might not work out because, you know, you're taking the detour. You're using time to first get the coconut down and get it going. But once you got that process up and running, it's so much more efficient in a certain sense of that term that eventually you're getting way more gallons per hour of your labor time that you put in. And then the other, you know, the real sophisticated technique where you're digging a channel and so forth, it would take you a long time to get it up and running. But once it is up and running, for a very small input of your labor to keep it going, you'd be having gushers of water come in. And so eventually that technique would swamp in terms of calculating how many gallons of water per hour of your labor does this technique yield. Okay, so that's the sense in which the more roundabout techniques are more physically productive. It's just they tend to take longer. And also there's a selection bias at work, or a selection mechanism, right, that if there existed a more physically productive, more roundabout technique that was shorter, you already would have used it. So in equilibrium, it's going to be the case that for you to switch to a more roundabout process that's more physically productive, you're going to have to wait longer for the end product. Not because technologically speaking, that's always the case, but just because given the selection thing that, you know, you already would have used the low hanging fruit, as it were. Okay, so that's the trade-off involved, and here I'm tiptoeing up to Bombavrick's grand theory of capital accumulation and how is it that when people save more and they're willing to defer consumption, that raises the average physical productivity of labor and so forth, right? So I'm not going to go into that. There are some serious problems with Bombavrick's attempts to formulate all that stuff, in particular his average period of production. There's, you know, a lot of stuff that he was saying that was very intuitive, but then later economists started really taking pot shots at it and thinking about it. Like, oh, wait a minute, we can come up with examples that don't fit your model. And so that's all true, that there are some serious problems with that. But intuitively, I think you can probably already see where he's going with it. Thinking in terms of these concepts. Let me very quickly, in Austrian, more modern Austrian terms, just say what his idea was. So as society becomes more patient, their time preference falls, they're willing to save more. If you're willing to wait longer for the finished product, then the amount of the product you get per unit of your inputs can go way up, right? So if you absolutely need to get that gallon of water into your bathtub as fast as possible, like, you know, you've got a turtle or something that's dying, or a fish or something, it's salt water, but you don't know, if you really got to get water in that bathtub immediately and you don't need that much water in there, you just need to get some in there fast, you might just run back and forth, cup in your hands, because you can't wait. But if you're saying, no, I would like to take a bath later tonight, and so I just, you know, I've got 3 hours to work with, but I'd like to fill that thing up, well, then you go ahead and you get your coconut and hollow that out, and that's a much more effective use of your time. That way, you'd be able to fill that bathtub up and still have leisure left over. Whereas if you just did it running back or even walking back and forth, that would be a very low productivity approach. And then if you're saying, oh, well, geez, I'm going to be on this island for 30 years, I might as well, you know, really invest a lot of my labor time up front in something that's going to pay off down the road. Well, then you go ahead and you build that real elaborate contraption. And so you can see how your willingness to defer consumption, right? Because while you're hollowing out the coconut, you don't have any water in the bathtub. And while you're knocking down you're building an axe so you can knock down trees, so that you can build shovels, so that you can start digging the trench, you know, while you're doing all that, you don't have any water in the bathtub either. You're just being motivated by this prospect of, down the road, think of how wealthy I'm going to be. All right. So that's the interplay between being willing to defer consumption and enjoyment and to be able to adopt very roundabout but very physically productive processes so that once they're up and running and you start calculating what's the flow of consumption output relative to the amount of your labor time you're putting in, it's a really big number. So all of a sudden, your labor is augmented. Okay, so that in case you didn't realize it, Bombavrick is here explaining why is it that using capital goods raises the standard of living. There's a sense in which, like, the labor time you use with your bare hands before any capital goods exist in order to first build some capital goods, and then you start using the capital goods, and then augments your productivity, that more than pays for itself if you're disregarding the time element. And then you can sort of, you know, bootstrap it where then you use the primitive capital goods to help you build even more capital goods, and so on. And that's the march of civilization. Okay, so there you go. That was kind of a little digression into Bombavrick's grand vision. But now returning to the more mundane task, how does that observation about the physical productivity of more roundabout processes, how does that explain interest, or how does that help to explain interest? So Bombavrick argues that, okay, notice what I just said there. The longer, more roundabout processes are more physically productive. So what that means is the earlier I have access to factors of production, right, whether it's an hour of labor or an acre of farmland or a tree, some coconuts that are hanging in a tree, whatever, the sooner I get my hands on those factors of production, that means I have more options in terms of how long, how roundabout of a process do I want to put them in. Okay, so for example, let's say what I'm trying to do is fill up my bathtub by tonight at, you know, 8 p.m. And right now it's noon. So I've got 8 hours to work with. And I'm considering the different options. You know, if I do the just cupping my hands and walking back and forth, that's an immediate process. That doesn't take any lead time. If instead I want to do the coconut approach, maybe that takes an hour to get going. So then once I do that, then I would have 7 hours of using the coconut. Okay. And suppose there's different ones too. I'm not going to bother dreaming them up, but you get the pattern there that it's more physically productive if I have it invested in a longer project or process, but obviously it takes longer. So if what I want is to have those gallons of water in the bathtub by, what did I say, 8 p.m., I have to take that into account. So if there's a project or a process that takes 5 hours to complete, well, if I don't get my hands on labor hours until 5 p.m., well, then I can't invest those labor hours in that kind of a process, right? Because I only have a three-hour window at that point. Whereas if I have a labor hour earlier by at least 3 p.m., well, then I can invest it in a five-hour project. So that's the sense in which a labor hour available at 3 p.m. is more valuable to me than a labor hour that's not going to be available until 5 p.m. Let me just say that one more time just to make sure I didn't lose you guys. Imagine that there's a particular process where I use my labor hours and I first do one thing, like I go get a stick and then I spend an hour sharpening, you know, getting more sticks and tying them together with vines. And then I go and I knock down some really big coconuts that are really high up that I can't just get without a stick. I can't climb and reach them. These particular coconuts I saw on the other side of the island, they're way up there. But man, these are big coconuts. But I need to get these long sticks, right? So I have to first devote a lot of my labor time to building the tools necessary to go knock down these coconuts. And also they're real thick, so I got to go find some big rocks to crack them open. But the point is, if I have 5 hours to work with, the first 4 hours are just prep, me building tools to then get the tools to then make the tool. But then once I have these huge coconuts that are all hollowed out, I mean, they're awesome. They're like big bowls. They're like, you know, salad bowls. like sailed mixing bowls. That's how big these things are. And so if I take the 4 hours to get a bunch of those things, and then I go and I fill those up at the stream and go, then that last hour, boom, 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 I fill the bathtub right up. And it's real easy too. It's not hard work. Okay. So the idea is, imagine again, if I have 5 hours to work with, that's really the best way to use my labor time. But again, it takes 5 hours if I do that approach, because there's all that upfront prep work. So if that's the situation I face and I want to be able to take my bath at 8 p.m., if I have a labor hours, or let's just do one, if I'm considering and say a labor hour that's available to me right now where I can start that process, you know, I can start going and getting the poles or the, you know, the sticks to and the vines. If I have that available at 3 p.m., then I can start that 5 hour process. But if for some reason I don't have my labor to be able to devote to this project, that's not going to be available until later, then that's not going to be as valuable to me. Okay. I realize it's a little bit tricky. You're like, well, don't you need to use the whole, like, don't you need 1 hour of labor sequentially? Yes. I'm trying to keep things simple without making this discussion too complicated, but I hope you're seeing the idea there that it makes, it's not just quantity of labor hours. Yeah. Like maybe if somebody was helping me too, you know, it's that kind of thing too. All right. If you want to look at some, maybe somebody Friday's helping me, and the idea is, no, we need to first spend an hour building those poles and stuff. Okay. So the point being that there's a sense in which having an hour available at 3 p.m. is more valuable to me than having the hour not available until later. And it's not because I'm going to grow wealthier over time, and it's not because I'm discounting the future psychologically. It's because of this very particular situation where there's these technological considerations, and the longer I have to work with, the more physically productive my labor hours are going to be, even for a fixed endpoint. So we're not saying, oh, the earlier I have my labor hours available, the earlier I can get the output, and I'd rather get the goods sooner rather than later. No, I'm saying I'm taking the bath at 8 p.m., period. So this isn't a question of time preference regarding the output good. It's just saying the earlier I get those labor hours under my command, I can have more gallons of water in my tub at 8 p.m. Because if I have the labor hours sooner rather than later, I can start a longer process, a more roundabout process that's more productive, meaning by 8 p.m. I get more gallons in there compared to the total number of labor hours I spent total on the project. Okay, so hopefully I at least got the spirit of it across to you guys. So that's the sense in which Bumbavrick is saying productivity can be involved with interest, but notice the way that it's one of three separate causes that are independent, he thought. And there, so notice, it's not that Bumbavrick is saying there's two causes of interest, time preference and productivity. No, he's saying interest is due to present goods being more subjectively valuable than future goods, period. End of story in terms of what causes interest. But now if you're saying, okay, but tell me more. Why are present goods more valuable than future goods? Now Bumbavrick goes, oh, okay, well, there's three separate reasons. The first is, generally speaking, you expect to be wealthier over time. So just in terms of diminishing margin utility, you would tend to prefer a unit of a present good versus a unit of a future good. A second reason is, for psychological reasons, we just tend to discount future satisfactions per se just because they're in the future and they're remote. And then the third reason is, empirically speaking, roundabout processes tend to be, or you can always find a roundabout process that's more physically productive. It's not that any old roundabout, but you can always find a more physically productive, more roundabout process. So the longer you have to work with, the more physical output you can get at any future point you want. And so that's a separate reason that you would tend to prefer getting command of resources in the present, or sooner rather than later, because other things equal, the earlier you get command over those resources, the longer, more roundabout processes you can deploy them in. And that gives you more output. And Bumbavrick, you know, so some critics like Fisher said, oh, well, that third reason is just your first reason in disguise. That it's just, you're saying if you get resources sooner rather than later, you have more stuff. And that's what your first cause was. And Bombavik, I think, convincingly showed that, no, that those are separate things. All right, it's not worth our time here to go through it. In my dissertation, now that I've kind of explained the big picture, if you really want, you can read my dissertation. You can probably follow it, right? Except for the mathematical appendix, my dissertation's not, it doesn't have like a lot of equations and stuff. It doesn't have like technical symbols. It's just kind of tough concepts. But now if you followed the discussion in this episode, you could read the dissertation if you want to go see more particulars. Okay. We're almost done. Hang on, folks. At this point, you probably want to take a bath, don't you? So we also would have accepted, this episode is pretty roundabout. Am I right? Okay, we're almost done. Very quickly, Keynes objected to Bombavik's third ground because he said it was merely a selection bias. He was saying, oh, we don't like to wait. We're impatient. And so the only reason you would tolerate a longer, more roundabout process as if it were more physically productive. But Keynes said, that's not a cause of a preference for future good or for present goods. He said, any more than couldn't I equally validly say other things equal a smellier process in equilibrium is going to be more physically productive, right? Because the only reason you would tolerate a process that gave off a bad odor is if it produced more physical stuff, right? If you had two equally productive processes and one was very smelly and the other one wasn't, you wouldn't use the smelly one. So that's showing why in equilibrium, if people move to a smellier process, it would have to be because it was more productive. And so Keynes says, well, but I don't see Bombavik lifting up smelly processes as a cause of interest. And even though that's very clever, I don't think that's right. And so in my dissertation, if you care, I show how Bombavik addresses that. That no, there is an important sense in which it makes sense to say roundabout processes being more physically productive gives an independent cause to the preference for present over future goods, whereas you wouldn't say that for smelly processes. Okay. But now where we're going here, the ultimate destination is Frank Fetter and Ludwig von Mises. So Fetter was a fan of Bombavik, and he gave him proper homage and said he did a great job, you know, paving the way, helping us pierce through all the confusion surrounding this very difficult topic. But he says, alas, at the final moment, Bombavik himself ironically relapsed into the old productivity fallacies that he himself had shown us, you know, how to cut down. And so Fetter thought that all we needed to do was just think of it in terms of time preference. That, no, it's the present valuation of future goods over, or the fact that present goods are more valuable than future goods. That's it. That's the end of the story. And productivity doesn't play any role in it. And what Fetter offered was what he called the capitalization theory. And so Fetter said, no, Bombavik, look, you know, he's saying, I feel funny saying this. I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but because you taught me this, Bombavik, but look, it's the productivity of capital goods does not explain interest. It explains the rental price or the rental rate of those capital goods. And then when you want to say what's their purchase price, you have to discount those future rents into a present discounted value using some discount rate that is itself due to time preference, psychological time preference. The fact that present goods subjectively are more valuable than future goods. That's how you know how to discount those future rents to come up with a present discounted value. And since you are discounting those future rents at a positive discount rate, that's why someone who invested funds in the capital good up front over time would earn a higher total return or total receipts in excess of the money he put in up front because those rents had been discounted. So the fact that your tractor is going to yield you $10,000 next year, or let's say it's going to yield you $100,000 over a 10-year horizon, the present purchase price of that tractor is not a full $100,000. You're calculating the present value by discounting those future cash flows according to some discount rate. And so in particular, like that 10th burst of $10,000 is not going to occur for 10 years. That right now is not valued anywhere near $10,000. But then that's why when you buy the tractor now for $85,000, and then over 10 years you collect $100,000, that's why you've collected more than you put in up front. And that's why it seems like, oh, look, at you're earning a positive rate of return. You're getting more dollars out of this tractor than you pumped in originally. And again, Fetter stresses, the reason for that excess return, if that's what you want to call it, has nothing to do with the physical productivity of the tractor. The physical productivity of the tractor explains why does it rent for $10,000 a year? Why is that the net income that it throws off? If the tractor weren't as productive, if you had a tractor that was only half as productive, it would only earn $5,000 net income. It's not that the rate of return would be half as much. The rate of return on a super productive tractor and on a crappy tractor would be the same rate of return. It's just the original purchase price would be half as much for the tractor that was only half as productive. But the rate, the percentage rate of return would be the same in both instruments. And it has to be, right? It couldn't possibly be the case that in equilibrium, capitalists earn a higher rate of return on the really productive capital goods, because then everybody would flow into those, right? The rate of return has to be the same, adjusting for risk, across all instruments. So clearly the productivity of the goods per se can't be the explanation because they have different productivities. Okay, so that's all true. Everything Fetter said is right. But Bumbavark would say, yeah, no kidding, I know that. And he's saying, when I'm talking about the enhanced physical productivity of more roundabout processes, and I'm not saying I can produce more with a coconut. I can get more gallons of water into my tub with a coconut than without. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying a labor of my time devoted to getting water into the tub is more physically productive if I first go and knock down a coconut and hollow it out. So in other words, if I take 10 hours of my labor, well, if I take 5 hours of labor, and I, on the one hand, spend 5 hours just going back and forth from the stream with a cup in my hands, I can get a certain amount of gallons in the tub. Or if I take 5 hours of my labor and get the coconut, blah, 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 and do it that way, I can get more gallons in there. So my labor, in terms of gallons per hour, is more productive if I go the route with the coconut. All right, so that's... that's certainly not the naive productivity theory. Again, remember what I said in episode 26. There's a reason Bumbavark used that term naive in there. He wasn't ruling out all productivity explanations. He was just saying a real naive one that merely says you can produce more with capital goods than without. Clearly, that's not the explanation. So I think partly why he said that and said that word, put that term naive in there, is because he knew he himself was going to use productivity as being involved in the overall worldview or understanding of the phenomenon, but he was just saying you got to be real careful about how does it enter into the discussion. Okay, and then what did Mises do? Mises basically adopted Fetter's theory. It's just that Mises put it on an a priori foundation. All right, so again, Fetter said that interest is due to time preference, the fact that present goods are more valuable than future goods, subjectively speaking. That explains it. And that, but for Fetter, psychological time preference was just an empirical fact. And you could logically imagine humans having negative time preference. You know, you could imagine humans thinking that future goods are more valuable than present goods, or you could imagine them, you know, trading at par. Whereas Mises loved the pure time preference theory of interest that Fetter developed. And again, just to not confuse you, Fetter didn't call it the pure time preference theory of interest. Fetter called his own explanation the capitalization theory. But Mises is saying it's a pure time preference theory. So again, Mises, because what happened, I realize I'm splitting off into tangents here, but it's there's a lot I'm realizing I haven't told you guys yet. So what happened is Bombavrick does all this path-breaking pioneering work, and then Irving Fisher comes along, and he takes a lot of Bombavrick's insights, but condenses it, crystallizes it into a more standard, mainstream, guys, you could call it neoclassical approach, where he's saying, oh, you've got your subjective time preference schedules, right? So people's desires subjectively, their trade-offs between present and future goods, in terms of if you just ask them, you know, how would you rank various bundles of future, present and future goods in terms of like an indifference utility map, if you know that terminology. If not, don't worry, it's not a huge deal. And then there's the technological element of how can we physically transform present goods into future goods using capital technologies. And so, and then it's, you know, the intersection or the interaction of those two forces. There's the subjective time preference element and the objective capital productivity element, the fact that if we're willing to wait, we can physically transform present goods into more future goods, and that interacts with our subjective impatience or time preference, the fact that psychologically we don't want to have to wait, and then those two things interact with each other, and so then in equilibrium we get the equilibrium real interest rate. And so Mises, so there's a sense in which the standard mainstream approach thinks that subjective time preference and objective capital productivity both mutually determine simultaneously what the equilibrium real rate of interest is. Whereas Mises says, no, that's fallacious. I uphold, following the tradition of Frank Fetter, a pure time preference theory, meaning the productivity of capital has nothing to do with interest per se. All the productivity of capital has to do with is the rental price of the capital goods. It explains, you know, the price per unit of time they command. Just like nobody says the productivity of labor has anything to do with interest rates, right? What's the wage rate? It's the, you know, the marginal product of labor. How much does a worker earn per unit of labor time he spends in production? Likewise, the productivity of a tractor, that's how much the tractor earns per unit of time it's used in the production process. If nobody would even think of saying, oh yeah, the rate of interest is determined by the marginal product of labor, well, Mises is saying, why the heck would you say the rate of interest is determined by the marginal product of capital? It's the same thing. It's just one's a human being and one's a machine. It's the same principles, though. Okay. So, by the way, I like to pat myself on the back. I think actually that's my little contribution. I'm sure Mises would be happy with what I just said, but I don't think he actually said that. I think I'm the one that's trying to shake neoclassicals and say you wouldn't say this with labor, because also you can blow people's minds by talking about a robot, right? Because a robot is a capital good. And so it's like, oh, the productivity of capital, or the marginal, you know, you add one more robot to your process, that's the marginal product of capital, and yet it's indistinguishable from a laborer. And so now, you know, in that kind of a world, would you say the marginal product of labor equals the interest rate? And even if you thought, okay, yeah, I guess it does, you'd still see that was just kind of a weird knife-edge result. It wouldn't be a conceptual thing. And so that's one way that I try to get mainstream economists to realize, wait a minute, something's screwy with the way we're thinking about this. Okay, anyway, let's walk back from me patting myself on the back. Back to Mises. So he's saying, I, Ludwig von Mises, uphold a pure time preference theory of interest. The productivity of capital has nothing to do with interest. Interest has to do with present goods being more valuable than future goods. And what Mises added that distinguished his approach from Frank Fetter was just that Mises gave it an a priori foundation. Mises thought that positive time preference was an a priori necessary feature of human action, whereas Fetter just thought it was an empirical regularity. Okay, so Mises thought action per se implied positive time preference, that we couldn't logically imagine a being that would not, other things equal, prefer a given satisfaction sooner rather than later. Okay, I will stop here, and next time I will, well, it might not be the next episode. The next time, though, in this series, I might have an interview that comes before, but when we do part 3, which will probably not be episode 29 of the Bob Murphy Show, we will conclude this series where I will again summarize what Mises' position was in the pure time preference theory, and then at long last I will explain what I think is wrong with it. Okay, everybody, thanks for hanging in there, and I will see you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.